I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of this day as voting day, but I'm not talking about the primary in New Hampshire. This was the day that millions of voters in Pakistan were supposed to be choosing a new president. It was anticipated as perhaps the first national and possibly democratic election in over 10 years there. But 12 days ago, the leading opposition candidate, Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated and the election's been postponed. Today, we look at life in Pakistan through the eyes of a young woman who was born there, educated in the U.S. and now hosts her own radio program in Karachi.
Baba O'Reilly, that's the who. We're going to take your requests, but you got to make them big, you got to make them massive, you got to make them...
Munise Sanai says that though the death of Bhutto shocked the country, life is returning to its city streets. Rush Hour Drive Radio and Reflections on Pakistan Today. That's all coming up right after the news. If you're walking past a newsstand today, take a glance at the latest cover of The Economist magazine. It shows a hand grenade with the word Pakistan stenciled on the side. The cover reads, "The World's Most Dangerous Place." We all heard about the recent assassination of Benazir Bhutto, but in recent days, lawlessness in Pakistan's tribal regions has become so unpredictable that thousands of villagers are now fleeing into Afghanistan for safety. That's right, Pakistani villagers are going to Afghanistan because they think it's safer than their home. Munise Sanai is staying put. She is a 26-year-old radio show host living in Karachi. She's from a privileged family and far from the tribal tension in the north, but still, she says, she has a hard time explaining Pakistan. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
If you were caught in the late-day clamor of Karachi traffic, you might send your car radio in search of City FM 89 and a show called The Rush Hour, hosted by Munise Sanai.
City FM 89.
This is Queen with I Want to Break Free. Yeah, this is The Rush Hour, only on City FM 89 with me, Munise.
I want to break free.
Munise Sanai has a perspective on her home city of Karachi that very few people share. She was born and raised there, but went to Bennington College in Vermont, spent 5 years in the U.S., and returned to Pakistan about 3 years ago. 12 days ago, she was on the air when Benazir Bhutto was killed.
I was doing my rush hour show, and it was between 5 to 7 p.m., and I had come out of the studio for a minute during playing a song, and our TVs were on because the news was breaking that there had been a bomb blast at a rally in Rawalpindi, where our shows actually transmit to. And while I was standing there, the information had also come in that Benazir Bhutto had been injured. We had wondered if we should, say something about this, but at the same time, we're not a news channel. We don't have to. We don't have the responsibility to give breaking news in any way, especially because we can't confirm it. So given that, I'd come back to carry on with the show, and I was in the middle of speaking before a song that my engineer came in, and once I finished my link, he told me that she had been assassinated, at which point I turned to my text messages, and the text messages had already been starting to come in saying the same thing and questioning why we were still playing music because of what had happened. And we changed our music very quickly to something that was a lot more soothing, a lot more respectful, and then decided what to do from there. I mean, the first thing we had to do was get everyone out of our office because we're in a part of the city which is a very high traffic area, and we knew what this city would turn into. And sure enough, it did, and a lot of people, including me, didn't make it out of here in time. Traffic got packed up and backed up in a matter of minutes. And then once we started hearing reports of the violence that had started taking place around Karachi, everyone was told to sit put. And we stayed here till almost midnight. And I watched from the roof of my building as 8 men put an abandoned bus on fire right on a ramp outside of our building. And there were gunshots and violence, and you could see a sense of like angst, and there was some rioting going on. So we all stayed put until that subsided, and then we made a run for it.
You went home.
I went to pick up my uncle, who was in another scary part of Karachi, and was more petrified than happy to see me, because it was very dangerous to be moving around at that time.
Yeah. Munise, when you were up on the roof of the building and watching them torch the bus and listening to the gunfire and aware of the fact that Bhutto had been assassinated, what was going through your mind? What were you thinking at that time?
That this is the world I live in, that I can't make sense of this, and I know that if I asked any of the people who were committing these acts, I know that they couldn't make sense of it either. And so what was the reasoning behind this? It was just something that I couldn't wrap my mind around. I mean, it was just very sad because this is the city I know and love, and it can suddenly turn into something so violent and so hateful. And that was, it was sad. It wasn't as scary as it was just very, very sad.
What about the days after the assassination? Did you come to work? Could you go on with a social life at all? Or did things become a lot more closed down?
This was the biggest thing in the city. I mean, Karachi, you have to understand, is a city that's vibrant and moving and constantly at a very fast pace. There are cars, buses, rickshaws, donkey carts, people, motorcycles on the road at all times. Even, you know, very late into the night, it's very rare that you'll see Karachi without, you know, just completely quiet. But that was the scariest bit, that the roads were empty, the shops were bolted shut. People were missing out on their daily wages, which is what they survive on, because they couldn't open anything. We couldn't get to work at all. People couldn't get their hands on flour, food, because for 3 days there was no movement. So all these things had the city at a standstill, complete standstill. And so you should just feel that a little bit of soul had been sucked out of the city.
I know you have family and lots of friends here in the U.S. Were people here calling you and saying, Munise, get out of there?
Yes, one of their favorite things to say is, well, just come back. And it's like, it's not that easy. It's not that easy to just pull out. But that just comes with the territory.
So what do you say to them when they call and say, come back? What do you say?
I say I can't just yet. Because the other part of it is, I've got a lot of people that I love here. Especially, I mean, if we look at just family, and it's just either we all leave or we all stay put. Because if any one person leaves, I would be really scared if we would ever be able to, you know, connect again in a sense. Because what we're all going through and what we're all experiencing here isn't translatable. It's not something that I can explain. It's very personal. And the fact that we're all going through it together makes us stronger for it. I remember when I was in the States and there were some riots happening here. This time I was in L.A. And to me, it just looked like the streets of Karachi were constantly on fire. I thought they were ablaze. And I was calling home and saying, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? They're like, look, it's okay. This and this is happening. And there's a bit of a situation, but it's under control and it will be handled. But I was just worried constantly for the safety of the people that I loved here, because it's very hard to see what happens when you're not here. It's, you can't understand it. It doesn't make sense. But watching it on the news is one thing. Experiencing it yourself is a completely different situation.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Munise Sanai hosts a drive-home program on City FM in Pakistan's commercial capital of Karachi. She says the whole country remains in a state of political apprehension. And that started 6 weeks ago with the great parades that welcomed Benazir Bhutto back to Karachi.
We had been given the day off because she was meant to pass through the road where our office is. They had actually blocked this entire road.
And so were you watching it on television when the first assassination attempt occurred?
Not at that time, because it was pretty late at night, but we heard about it pretty quickly. And the question was always in everyone's mind, like, if you cannot protect somebody like this, how are you going to offer protection to the rest of the country?
And did it change in any way your own perspective of living in Karachi, living in Pakistan?
It's as simple, Dick. You just want to see this place do well. And you keep coming up with hurdles, and these hurdles are people whose reasons you just question constantly because you can't make sense of them. So it's frustrating because here you are at one end hoping for the best, but knowing how difficult it is to get it, because there's always going to be somebody who wants... who just wants to mess it up for no reason. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing we live with. You can just turn a blind eye and say, well, this is just the world I live in. I can't do anything about it. But some of us can't do that. And here we are constantly trying to pick it all back up again and say no.
And you still have that sense that it's in your own way and among your friends, it's still up to you guys to try and make something of Pakistan. I mean, I ask you the question, Manisa, because it's actually kind of encouraging for me to hear from you. You live there. You know this city. It's in your blood, and it's a puzzle. It's frustrating for you to try and make sense of it because it's a puzzle for all the rest of us, too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely there, that the fact that we're not going to do it, nobody else will. But it's very hard to keep trying to pick yourself back up again, because at no point can you secure your own future, whether it be something as simple as a radio campaign we'd planned. We had a whole, you know, election planning and campaign down in order to talk to people about the elections and the process. But now we've had to readjust that, even though that was our programming for the first week of January. So you're constantly having to reevaluate where you're going to be and what you're going to be doing. Am I making a career, or is this just going to keep happening until one day something changes so drastically that this can no longer be a career path and a career choice? But what choice do you have, right? If you can't look forward, where else do you have to look?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the election, because this is the time that you and everyone else in Pakistan was meant to be voting. Is there a... I won't ask you about the country itself, but what do you think about that? Are you frustrated by the fact that, you know, the election was there and now it's not?
The election is a bit of a sensitive topic, because I think I'm not one who believes in voting for the lesser of two or three evils. I believe that a choice should be there that should be crystal, and you should be hoping for the best from that one person. And again, personally and honestly, I can tell you that I didn't see how we were going to be able to make that choice given the current standing and the choices that we had.
And what about today? It's been almost 2 weeks since the assassination. Did you get a sense, or was there a moment when you saw Karachi sort of coming back to life?
Absolutely. It's a restless city. It's restless. It's people want to work. You know, some people are living it up and some people are working to survive. And based on that, they cannot stay shut down. I remember the third day after the assassination, my mother and I ventured out, and we were out to pick something up, something very important. And in the meanwhile, we said, okay, let's just turn into this commercial area and see if something's open. And the stores were still closed, but there was a man standing outside a store with the shutters down, and there was another man on the inside of the store. And what you could do is that you could go and talk to this man standing outside, tell him what you need, and if they had it, they would slide it from under the shutters. And that's what they were doing, because, again, it's a day-to-day wages-based society, and a lot of it needs to sustain itself by keeping some sense of moving on and keeping it going. I think people are still affected.
When I come back in a moment, I'll talk more with Munize Sanai from Karachi. She went to college in Vermont. She lived in L.A. She spent 5 years in the U.S., but Munize is now back in her hometown and helping us make sense of one of the most complicated places on Earth. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with the Pakistani radio host Munize Sanai about her life today in Karachi. And I must say I have my own personal fascination with her hometown. When I worked as a correspondent in South Asia, I was often in Karachi. This was the mid-90s, and it was the same story then. Street-side killings, bombs at rival mosques, all of it fueled by tribal and religious and political differences that seemed almost impossible to untangle. The odd thing was that covering the killing in Karachi was usually a civilized assignment. At the end of a day's reporting, I'd go back to the cool marble lobby of a 5-star hotel. Munize says that's a part of the contradiction she lives with. She was also in Karachi then, a high school student, but she lived with the privileged set, well apart from the street violence.
I have to tell you, I mean, being a kid here was just great. You felt invincible, because I have had a gifted upbringing. We went to private schools here, which is a very different experience than going to the public schools. You pretty much didn't know any better. I think our parents took the brunt of the worrying. But looking back and looking through what was going on in Karachi at the time, there was a lot of civil unrest. And, I mean, I have to say that I was lucky enough not to be touched by it. But going away and then coming back, suddenly a lot more conscious, you feel it a lot more and a lot harsher.
When you were a high school student in Karachi, were you free enough to walk on the street, to go shopping, that sort of thing? I mean, I was working at that time as a reporter based in Delhi, and I came into Karachi a few times to cover that very civil unrest that you were talking about. And, you know, there are parts of the city, you know this better than I do, parts of the city where people would get up in the morning and there'd be, you know, dead bodies lying in the parks, and the ambulances would just drive around and pick them up.
Absolutely. There was a lot of that going on, but there's differences in what people do. We don't do a lot of walking in the city. I mean, at least I don't. I think that's one of the things I've always noticed, that your experience with the city really greatly depends on how you have to transport yourself through it. Either you're driving in cars or you're being driven in public transport, which can range from rickshaws to buses to taxis, or you're riding a donkey cart or, you know, something like that. Certain areas of Karachi are far more volatile, but then there are certain areas, like I have to say I'm lucky enough to be from, that were a lot safer. And that's the biggest difference, the distinctions between who are the haves and the have-nots. It's huge. The lines that separate us are massive.
Yeah, and you spent 5 years in the United States. You lived in Vermont. You lived in L.A. L.A. would be a good example of a city, I suppose, where there are similar parallels. It's easy to live well on the West Coast, and there's also really dangerous parts of that area.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not something that doesn't happen everywhere else in the world. It's just the level with which it happens here. There's a lot more volatility there. When there's violence, there's a lot more violence because there are a lot more people in a city where there are over 16 million people. You can expect there to be a lot of people who are unhappy. And when you've got a lot of people that are unhappy in their environment, they're going to try and do whatever they can, by whatever means they can, to provide for themselves. And given that, we've always had to be very conscious and try very hard to make sure that our parameters as such are secure. I mean, I know everyone, a lot of people here who've had their cell phones stolen with a gun pointed at them while they're stopped at a traffic light. It's that easy. General thievery and, you know, somebody walking into your house to rob it is something that happens on a day-to-day basis, citywide, nationwide.
Has any of this ever happened to you?
My house was robbed, yes, about a year and a half ago, when about, I think, five people walked into it with guns and tried to steal whatever we had in the house in the way of jewelry or money. And I wasn't home at the time, but my grandmother was, and it was a very traumatic affair.
Did they hurt her?
No, they did not.
And did you change the security at your place in any way?
Yes, we now have a guard guarding our house with a gun.
And is that normal for people living in the upper class in Karachi?
Well, that, yes, it is very normal, as well as having, guards with weaponry as such are guarding almost everything between office buildings, offices, banks, stores.
And what about the radio station?
Yes, we have a guard.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm talking with Munise Sanai from Karachi. She hosts a music radio program there. As I mentioned earlier, Munise was educated in the U.S. She speaks English on her show. She plays a lot of Western music. She's a public figure there. And so I asked her in the wake of the Bhutto assassination if she ever fears that she might be a target of the extremists.
I can't say I think about it like that. I know for a fact that what I'm doing is absolutely right. It's a freedom of choice, and we celebrate it. Music gives us the ability to express and say things sometimes that language just can't. And bringing people that world and giving people that opportunity to explore something that we never really had access to before only opens up their world.
But what you're telling me is that it's not just entertainment. You're telling me that it is at least a small p political act to provide this access to music and something new and something different to people in Karachi.
I wouldn't call it political. I would call it more social, to give people something more than they could have imagined, and that'll just help them imagine better.
But don't you think that there are some people, religious extremists, who would see that as a political act?
Well, that's their problem.
I agree with you, but if it's their problem and they choose to do something about it, then don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that you should leave. You're doing something, you know, too provocative, but people are trying to shut down Western influences.
I wouldn't say so, though, Dick. I mean, there have been a lot of influences that have been coming in, and they haven't really been assaulted as such. We haven't faced anything like that yet. And I hope that day doesn't come, because I think people have started letting radio and music and everything become a part of their lives. And that's not been there before. The idea that you have a choice to make in any realm and in any lifestyle that you want, and that it breeds tolerance.
Like you, I work in radio and you know, often get feedback from listeners that say, yeah, you know, we like what you're doing or we don't like what you're doing. How about you? Do you get that kind of feedback from your listeners, people saying, we like it, we need it, we want more, stuff that you know, that helps you get up in the morning and do your show every day?
Absolutely. This is my favorite example. I had an eighth grade teacher. She teaches at a public school in Karachi. And she told me that she instructs her kids as almost homework to tune into our station for at least an hour a day, because it will help them speak English better and learn English better. And they enjoy it, and they come back and they tell us what they heard. They write reviews on the things they heard on us and what we talked about. And for me, even thinking along the lines that we were at all providing something like that to someone is just, it's the most gratifying thing. And yes, Pakistan's a hard place to live sometimes. It's very hard not to get run down, and it's very hard not to become subject of uneducated opinion. But you kind of always have to know what's right and what's wrong. And I think that's where the problems come, that sometimes people get confused because they haven't been shown ways to make those distinctions.
You said to me a little while ago that if we, meaning you, if we aren't going to do it, nobody else will. Are you feeling that resolve perhaps even more these days?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Going on air now has a completely different feeling. Like, I just want to be there, and I just want to give people listening in an experience that just really gives them something. It gives them something to hold on to. And I know, again, it's just music, but I truly believe that it has powers that I can't explain, and it really gets inside you and just, it drives you. It becomes a driving force. It's up to us to put together a sense of normalcy into people's lives. We have to, they turn to you, and it is up to us to make sure that when they come to us, we've got something for them.
Manuze, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to spend it with us here on The Story.
It was absolutely an honor.
Manuze Sanai is host of The Rush Hour on City FM 89 in Karachi, Pakistan. Manuze talked with me about her belief in the healing power of music. Here's a song that has just that kind of power.
Ancestors are calling. I can see acacia trees bathing in the river Nile, echoes of my mother's smile.
This is the jazz singer who goes by the single name Somi. This is the title song from her new CD, Red Soil in My Eyes. Somi is every inch an African-American. She was born in the U.S. of Rwandan and Ugandan parents. She lived in Zambia, and she steps effortlessly between continents and languages. Somi told me that she grew up with music, and not just from the radio, and not just in church.
When we pray together, when we just sort of commune, and something that always sort of pulls the family together, always sort of solidifies the moment, begins and ends the experience with one another, is both song and prayer. Well, my mother has just a sincere joy for singing. She was always singing in the house. Every song, any kind of conversation I had with her, it seemed like she always had a song. When, you know, I would come home and tell her something, you know, if I had a bad day, then she'd sing a song about having a bad day, or, you know, and just, she just has a sincere joy for song in her heart. And also just as a child, I remember her always singing me to sleep, whether lullabies, traditional songs. She knows a huge, like, sort of, she has this encyclopedic knowledge of traditional folk songs from Western Uganda.
Any kind of signature song between the two of you, one that she knows you like and you know she sings well that she'll sing often?
She has this one song. It's like a song about a little bird, and it's a children's song. So it goes, A e I o rahai goror nyoru rahai goroku. A e I o rahai goror nyoru rahai goroku. And anyway, so it's like a, it's sort of teaching children about vowels, right? The a e I o.
Yeah.
We don't say ooh for some reason in that song, but it's sort of, it's really about this little bird and the sounds that it makes. And I just adored it as a little girl. So she would always sing it for me. Although her voice was always recognized in our family as being, you know, beautiful.
Yeah.
Everybody sings. I mean, the other day at the holidays, we started singing some song. My uncle was visiting and he's singing all the harmonies. And I'm always looking over like, you know, wow. You know, there's just, he's not somebody who necessarily is always singing and practicing and, you know, working on his ear. You know, he's just somebody who's like, okay, what's the tune? Here's the melody once, and holds down the tenor part, you know, and you're just like, okay.
And you're going, now I know where I get this.
Well, I'm just like, this is a wonderful thing. You know, I just, I'm really thankful for it. But then sometimes I start being like, well, is what I'm doing sort of frivolous and self-absorbed? Should I just stick to singing around the table with the family? Because they all sound good.
The jazz singer Somi says she was exposed to all kinds of music as a kid. She remembers one concert in Champaign, Illinois, one musician who made an impression on her.
I do remember seeing Stevie Wonder in the fifth grade.
Now New Year's Day.
You know, and like just the crowds and the energy on stage. That's probably the biggest sort of concert I saw as a child.
Did you get anywhere close to the stage? They didn't have a mosh pit for fifth graders, did they?
No, no. And actually, my mom came to get us before the end of the show, like, okay, bedtime. I don't know who she talked to at the gate, but she was like, my child's in there, I gotta go. So that always makes me laugh. But he did come to campus the next day, and my father took us over there. And so he let the children actually come close, and we got a chance to say hello. That was it.
And shake his hand?
Since, like, yeah, I did. But since then, I've seen him in New York, I think twice. But as an adult, obviously.
I mean, it's always interesting to me, Somi, to try and figure out if those encounters, you know, if they have influence on you.
You know, I don't know if they had. I always wonder that, too. Like, okay, so I listen to this. Does that mean that that's what I'm hearing in the music when mm-hmm. this happens? Or, you know, I think, say, for example, with that Stevie moment, more than anything, I was so impressed by his sort of service, you know, the service that he was doing. You know, it wasn't so much that I was watching him and studying the music, I don't think, at that moment. I think I was sort of watching his relationship with people. I remember just loving the fact that he came on campus, was talking to the students. It was this free, open, you know, air concert on the quad, and invited the children to come close to him. I thought that said something about his heart. You know, I remember being like, wow, he's so nice, you know, to have been this huge superstar and to be this huge superstar still. I think that sort of moved me. And, you know, obviously that's something that I think all artists should sort of aspire to, maintain a certain humility and humanity and, you know, and have a certain sort of rapport with the people.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The jazz singer Somi started her musical career playing the cello. She says she was a classical music geek when she was all of 8 years old. I asked her if she could pinpoint the moment when she first became aware of the power of music. She recalls that it began as something of a disagreement with her parents.
I was upset and, you know, maybe I was grounded, I don't know, but I went into my room and I sort of had this moment when I realized the healing properties of music, like how it can personally transform you spiritually, emotionally.
How old would you have been
psychologically?
At the time?
I think I was maybe sixth grade, so maybe 11.
Okay, so you go stomping into your room, slam the door.
I go stomping into my room, I pick up my cello, and I just start playing for hours and hours. And I remember getting dark in my room. I remember going in there when the sun was really high. And then when I stopped, it was dusk or it was dark in my room, but I remember sitting there and trying to be present in that feeling I was having at that moment, the vibrations from the cello, the just how I'd been able to sort of get into some sort of meditative state and lose myself in the music. I think that's what it was. It was the first time I had really lost myself in the music and emerged from that place feeling so much better and feeling so much clearer.
Do you remember what you were playing at the time?
I was just sort of playing what I felt and what I heard, which probably was my first experimentation with improvisation, just because in the classical, you know, school, you really are taught to stick to the page. So finding myself, you know, years later as a jazz vocalist, a genre that sort of encourages and in fact insists on improvisation, it was definitely like a difficult sort of hurdle to sort of let go in that way. But I think what happened in that moment was that was probably the first time that I let go. And maybe that was my first time sort of, you know, talking to jazz, or jazz was speaking to me, I'm not sure.
Somi's music has social weight as well. She's worked with AIDS orphans and kids in places like Kenya and Tanzania. She sings about the strength of African women. Most recently, she's been captivated by the profile Barack Obama is gaining in the U.S., and we'll talk about all of that and hear some more of her music in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The parents of the jazz singer Somi are from Rwanda and Uganda. She's lived all over the world. In fact, before she thought about a career in music, she studied to be an anthropologist. After college, she worked at an AIDS orphanage in Kenya. She thought the one thing she could do was bring a little bit of joy into their lives, but Somi found an unexpected challenge from the orphanage administrators.
What bothered me the most about that experience was I come in, I found upstairs in their attic that they had tons of toys and candies and things like that that hadn't been opened. This was a home to 47 HIV-positive children, all under the age of 11. And I remember saying, okay, why don't we do this and have them do these things and painting this and singing this and let's put together this like whole holiday season. You know, this was a Catholic organization and thinking this would make them happy and definitely make the children happy. And they were like, we don't want to spoil them. And I'm thinking, okay, these are kids, children who are constantly seeing their peers and those who they really consider siblings die, fall sick. They're in a lot of discomfort, you know, and just for them to sort of have this attitude of we're spoiling them or you're spoiling them. And what happens when you leave and there's nobody still sort of doing these things with them? And my attitude is I can appreciate maybe their concern, but the joy that I saw with the children once they were in groups singing songs and painting things and decorating, it was just, I think, in many ways, those memories remind me of how much a very small sort of initiative or action can really change the lives of many people, and in that particular case, the children. They hadn't had that experience from three-year-olds to, you know, on up. It was mind-blowing for them.
Any recollection of the music that you would be sharing with the kids at the time?
Well, the Swahili song that we sang every morning was Jambo, Jambo Pwana, Habari Kani, Mzuri Sana, Kwetu, Kavukari Bishwa, Taradeye, Hakuna Matata. I couldn't remember the lyrics.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. One song that's very firmly fixed in Somi's mind is a composition that she wrote to address the issue of domestic violence in Africa.
Strong and free. Remove yourself from misery. If you can't see the power in your soul, gather all your pride and go. Raisin babies, a razor queen, try to hire you, hear her scream.
She will say, she will say, I'm in radio.
I remember having a conversation one day with my mother's sister. She's a total feminist and champion of women's rights at home. And I remember her telling me about how in Uganda it was law for a man to beat his wife because technically she was his property. And I was like, so there's no recourse? There are no laws that protect her? And she said, no. I was so deeply disturbed by that. There's nothing to protect a woman. You know, and actually he's allowed to, you know, to beat her, he's allowed to rape her, he's allowed to, whatever it is. And a woman can actually have no defense if she is to bring charges. He can take her kids and there's no recourse for that at all. Like, and she's not protected. So it always sort of stayed with me. I don't want to perpetuate any sort of stereotypical notions of the African man. I know my father and my uncles and my brothers are very gentle men. So... And strong men, but gentlemen, you know? Yeah. I don't want to imply that African men, you know, they all beat their wives. But it does happen, just as it happens everywhere. The only difference is, at least between the States and at least Uganda, is just aren't that many rights to protect the woman. Nobody's going to come to your door and toss out the husband or arrest him. So it's just about trying to create a certain dialogue about domestic violence in Africa, on the African continent.
I wonder, though, Somi, if it's kind of a risky area for you to be in, or one where you have to tread a little bit carefully, because, you know, while you have all these wonderful African connections, you're also seen, I would imagine, by many people in Africa as an American woman, and you don't want to be seen telling them what to do. Do you know what I mean? You have to tread a little bit carefully here.
Perhaps, but you know what? I don't have that problem. At home, they look at me as a daughter of the land, and they don't look at me like, oh, she's, they just say, oh, she grew up in the States. But there are a lot of people with my experience, many of whom have either moved home or come home regularly. Like, I've been there 3 times this year already, or last year, I should say. So, I mean, yes, there are moments maybe, but that's more on a localized social kind of exchange
or a class proximity thing, right? They see the clothes that you're wearing and they might, you know, recognize in that something that they don't have access to.
Maybe. I mean, but you're talking about, I mean, frankly, the people who are listening to jazz and the people who I'm performing for when I go home are of a certain kind of class for the most part anyway. You know, obviously I'd like to reach beyond that, but for the most part, the people who are bringing me, they're not wanting. You understand what I'm saying? They're not looking at my clothes and saying, oh, I wish I could have that. So there's that, you know, it's not like I'm coming. Africa has changed drastically, especially in the post-apartheid era, where South Africa has really opened up a lot of things to the rest of the continent, provided a lot of things to the rest of the continent. So there's that aspect. I mean, when you start getting into you're the American cousin, it's really more on local, more localized social encounters, you know, like myself sitting at a, you know, going out with some relatives or friends, that's when you become more of the American. But
right.
On stage, they're just happy to see a Rwandese woman. I've been told this many times. They've told me they feel very proud to see a Rwandese or Ugandan woman on stage singing jazz because we don't really have that coming out of East Africa. So when they see someone who's singing in languages that they understand, they appreciate it, I think.
Bona meka kila kila siku meka sirika.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. This is an African love song performed by Somi. She seems to have such comfort with her family roots in Rwanda and Uganda and her place today here in America. I asked her what or where she calls home, or if that's an answer that changes.
Well, in the States, if I haven't said a word, sometimes people are asking me where I'm from because of how I look, you know, and they might be like, well, she kind of looks African, so I'll respond telling them I'm East African, I'm from Uganda and Rwanda. But if I'm having a conversation maybe with somebody who is African who's asking me that, I might tell them that I'm East African, but I grew up in the States mostly, you know. But if I'm in Rwanda or Uganda, for the most part, they assume by the way that I look, they can see my features and know which ethnic group I'm from, things like that. So if they're asking, they're really asking, where do you live?
It's a fascinating answer to the question, because one of the things about your music and your upbringing and all your connections both in the States and in Africa is that I was thinking before I had a chance to meet you that maybe you're of a generation where the answer to that question is going to be less important. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I always think, though, at the end of the day, people are going to ask that question because they're trying to understand, well, why are you singing in Kinyarwanda? Or why are you singing in Swahili? Or why are you, you know? So they want to understand that. And it's sort of outside of whatever, you know, we oftentimes were boxed into. Well, if this is your identity, say as a jazz singer living in New York, a black woman, they're expecting a certain thing. So when these other languages come out or other rhythms come out, then it becomes, it actually, in the first question that comes to mind is, well, where is she from? You know, so I don't think it's something I can avoid. But I think it's a really exciting time.
I guess in musical terms, though, it has maybe more implications, because if you say someone is an African singer, then someone says, oh, they have certain expectations about the music that they're going to hear. And if you say someone is a jazz singer, the expectations are completely different. So these lines in performers like you are beginning to blur in ways that they haven't before.
Right.
And that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I don't know if it's about blurring for me as much as it is about being able to speak from both experiences and both worlds, you know, finding harmony. It's not so much about blurring as it is about harmony for me. That's really where I am on that. I'm not trying to make it gray. I'm not trying to make it this nebulous space. I'm just trying to say, I've created a cultural space of belonging, at least in an African context, for this new African identity. Those people like myself, you know, you're from all over the place. I have tons of friends with my experience. I mean, that's what's been amazing about New York City for me, meeting people who've really experienced and asked the same sort of questions that I've always asked myself. I have a friend who's Ghanaian, grew up in Germany. She's now living here. So-and-so who's, you know, from Côte d'Ivoire, but lived in Paris, and then, you know, the Nigerians in London, the whoever it is, you know, they're from all over the place. And it doesn't even have to be these glamorous, very cosmopolitan cities. It can also be somewhere like Champaign, Illinois,
right,
wherever you're talking about, and their parents are from somewhere else, and they've had this very similar experience, you know. So it's just about being able to express them fully and really just carving out our own, like I said, our own cultural space of belonging.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. My guest is the jazz singer, Somi. She was watching TV late last week when she watched the presidential hopeful, Barack Obama, win the Iowa caucus. His speech caught her emotionally in a way that she says she never would have expected.
Hope. Hope is what led me here today. With a father from Kenya, a mother from Kansas, and a story that could only happen in the United States of America.
I remember watching his speech. To look and see an East African taking on this national role and actually being sort of embraced, he actually just reaffirms that we can have a space of belonging here. And I'm hoping that his presence sort of opens up an understanding or awareness of, like, the multiplicitous layers of a black experience, either here or in Europe or wherever it is.
But tell me about your own perspective on this now. You're a woman of some influence in that you're a performer and a songwriter. Are you going to become more politically engaged in what's happening here in the U.S. as a result of the early success of Obama?
Well, I mean,
are you writing campaign jingles?
I'm not writing campaign jingles, but, you know, my MySpace page does say Obama says it takes one voice to change a room. Oh, anyway, so I don't know if that's probably about as political as I'll get. I don't want to, you know, push people off. I know that it gets a bit touchy, especially those sort of politics. So I'm not trying to exclude anybody, but I am very, you know, outspoken about what I believe in. And I believe in Obama. He embodies and represents my experience.
Through it all, Somi says, her own family keeps her grounded. Every time her family holds a meeting, she says, there's music. And it's always the same music.
There could be three or four of us in the room to 20 or even 40 at times. My family's huge. You know, we have a conversation. It could be about a specific issue. It could be about a decision that we're all trying to make or that one person's trying to make, but the family gets involved to discuss how to move forward. Something terrible could be going on, and we're praying for a particular member of my family. After that, there's always like a short lull, and then somebody begins, usually my mother. And then you just hear my mother start day by day, and then everybody sort of joins in. Day by day, dear Lord, of these three things I pray, to see you more clearly, love you more dearly, follow you more nearly, day by day. Day by day.
Just when you think you've lost your edge, you got to keep on with faith and fury. You got to keep on until the end. I'm gonna take it day by day, day by day.
It's a lovely picture. I feel like you're really blessed to be a part of that family.
Well, I'm very thankful for them, definitely. You know, every day can be a new day. Every day can be a better day. When I think about that song, a funny story, you know, my mother used to sing that song and we'd all be singing with her. And I remember, you know, when you're growing up as a child, you're learning prayers and songs and you have no idea what you're even saying. You're just sort of regurgitating text and sound,
yeah.
You know? And I remember the first time, I think I was in middle school, or I don't know, I understood the words. It's very short, but my mother, with her accent, she doesn't say, follow you more nearly. She says, follow you more nearly. So it sounds like nearly, right?
Yeah.
And for so long, I was like, just singing with the accent. And then one day I was like, oh, nearly. Oh, dearly. And it's one of those moments when you realize that you've just been saying things. You haven't really been. But anyway, so when I really understood the lyrics, it's something that just always inspires me, always keeps me motivated and reminds me of the faith that we can find in ourselves and in our work and in our lives.
Beat up and beat, bum, bap, and bay. Beat up and beat, bum, bap, and bay. Beat up and beat, bum, bap, and bay.
Her name is Somi. She lives in New York City. This spring, a theater piece that she helped write will premiere at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. It's a play that examines racial tensions between Africans and African Americans living in the United States. If you visit our website, you can actually see a performance by Somi from her album, Red Soil in My Eyes. You can take a look at her blog and, if you're so inclined, leave a message on her MySpace page. And if you go to our website at thestory.org, you can also leave me suggestions for stories, reactions to what you're hearing on the program, and a suggestion of a story of your own. If you've got one to propose, we're always open to those. You can also leave me a message on our toll-free telephone line at 1-888-966-9862, the website, thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.